happy to be here tonight with Patrick Fannery. I'm really happy to be working on this project. I actually worked for Writers' Centre previously and left last summer and then got lured back with the promise of working on Brave New Reads. It's one of my absolute favourite programmes. It's really brilliant because it's a way of introducing people to books that they might not encounter otherwise. All of the books are chosen by Reader Circle members, which is really fab because they're chosen by readers for readers. And it's going from strength to strength. We're in our sixth year now, bigger and better than ever. We've gone on to 18 libraries across three counties, Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire. And we've got almost 70 events happening in all three counties, which is pretty impressive and takes quite a lot of organisation. As I said, Brave New Reads is unique because all of the titles were chosen by readers for readers. We started off with a long list of over 150 books, and our amazing reader circle spent 6 months reading all of these titles, sending us in thousands of reviews, and we ended up with these six brilliant books, which I think are on a display just over there. It really wasn't easy to get to those six books, and it took quite a lot of discussion and argument and people designing which ones they wanted to pick. And I'm really pleased with the ones that we've chosen because they really represent the kind of bravest and boldest in contemporary writing, and I really think they demonstrate Fallen Land, which is a chilling novel which explores the lives of the Noai family. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Yep. Yes. I had checked in the book for the correct pronunciation. And Paul Krovic and Louise Washington, who are three very different groups of people drawn together by the land that they live on with disastrous consequences. And Fallen Land is the most popular of our books so far. It had the highest loan figures in Norfolk out of all of the Brave New Reads books, which was 1,595 borrows, which is really amazing. So if you haven't read it yet, I would suggest borrowing it or buying it from our friends over in Dis. And I think that's all you need to hear from me because I'm not the interesting one here. So let's begin. Towards the beginning of the novel, Louise describes the land as having secret sliding ways, which seems to me a really accurate way to describe the book itself. And it's quite clear that you've linked the land and its shiftings with the narrative of Fallen Land. Did you find this happened quite naturally?
So do you mean whether that theme was sort of something that I was trying to work through in the form of the book as well?
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, at the beginning of the book, there's a story about a sinkhole opening up and swallowing a tree. And some readers have said, this is impossible. How could a sinkhole swallow a tree and two men in it? But that was something which actually happened on the property that I grew up on. Before we lived there, the previous owner was in the backyard trying to trim a pine tree, a 40-foot pine tree, and suddenly found himself 40 feet underground and managed to climb out, and he was fine. But growing up, that image was very kind of potently in my mind, and the place where that tree had fallen was always soft. Like, we could dump endless amounts of yard waste and clippings into it, and it would never grow, and it was always sort of spongy. And my mother was convinced that it was an Indian well, but in fact, Omaha, where I grew up, has quite a history of sinkholes. And there was another one nearby, which was so deep that we could drop a penny down and we could never hear it sort of land. And it was profoundly dark, and it was kind of open in a way that ours wasn't. So I wanted to think about that strange sort of sense of vulnerability right there on one's property. And then also, I guess, to play with the metaphor of that vulnerability. And so the book is really about all different kinds of domestic vulnerability and the way that domestic spaces become pregnable in some way.
Okay. That brings me on very nicely to my next question, which is... So within Fallen Land, it's the domestic space where the characters are most at risk. Although the outside world is eerie and threatening, most of the violence kind of occurs within the home. I'm trying not to give too much away from the book in case you haven't read it, but it almost seems that the more that they try to protect their homes, various characters, but all of the characters, the greater the chance of the invasion. So is the implication of this by engineering the protection and by fearing the invasion that we are in fact encouraging it? Is that something that you wanted to kind of create within it?
It's an interesting way of thinking about it. I guess it's something that I think about a lot in my first book, Absolution, which is set in South Africa. And one strain of that book is thinking about the security culture and the cultures, kind of growing cultures of surveillance in South African domestic life, and particularly in wealthy white areas. And I wanted this book in some way to work as a kind of pair with Absolution. So, I mean, they have nothing kind of narratively in common, but there's a lot that's thematically in common. They're both concerned with these cultures of surveillance, but also with dispossession and a kind of historical complicity. And I think it's the idea of living in a state of self-imposed surveillance is something that sort of began to strike me around 2005 when I was living in Sheffield. And I was there because my partner had taken a job at the University of Sheffield, and I was still finishing my doctorate at Oxford remotely. And it kind of coincided with all of the hysteria in the United States about people speaking out against what the US was doing in Iraq, and the sort of sense that anybody who was questioning American foreign policy was in some way almost enacting treason, or was committing something which was close to treason. And so I began to feel quite paranoid about everything that I was saying, everything that I was writing to family in the States, phone calls with my mother, who's a kind of firebrand radical. And I thought, what is being recorded potentially? And of course, the Edward Snowden revelations suggest that we were right to be slightly paranoid. But that sense that the private is no longer private, and that domestic space is no longer private space, not remotely, I think is hugely suggestive for the way that these characters, who have no idea of the way in which their home has been compromised from within, are going about their lives. So it was about trying to take that sort of global theme, if you like, and thinking about working it out in a very domestic way.
Okay, great, thank you. And following on from that, I found it very interesting that it seemed to me, at least within the novel, that the men found the domestic space the most threatening.
Mm.
Traditionally, of course, the domestic sphere is that of the woman. I mean, do you feel that perhaps the reason that the men have this great fear is because it represents the undermining of their masculinity and the kind of dispossession from the traditional male roles, which is definitely a kind of theme within the novel? Like, there's several points.
Well, so the two main male characters in the book are Paul Krovic and Nathaniel Noir. And Paul Krovic is the creator of this subdivision of kind of luxury ersatz Victorian houses. They're kind of pastiche Victorian houses. Really grotesque, kind of deformed Victorian houses on former farmland. And he has grown up with a very, very strict military father who's instilled in him a kind of crazy version of Emersonian self-reliance, which he doesn't fully understand. He has a very reductive idea of it. And he's a kind of Tea Party figure. You all know what I mean by the Tea Party in the States. It's this kind of right-wing libertarianism in the US. So that's his sort of position, and he loses his house and his development during the downturn in the States, and at the moment of that loss decides that he's not going to abandon the property, but in fact go into hiding in a fallout shelter in the backyard that's connected to the house but doesn't appear on the plans. So he's present there at the moment that the new family, who are kind of East Coast liberals who arrive from Boston, come. And they come into the house having no idea that he's present within it and watching them. And he's really determined somehow to win back the house, although he doesn't have a clear sense of what that means. So I was very consciously trying to think about kind of competing modes of masculinity, so that Paul is this kind of type A male figure, and Nathaniel is, I don't know, he's kind of a beta male, but he's much more sort of sensitive, ostensibly sensitive. He's kind of out of shape. He's kind of slightly bumbling as well. He's sort of a mid-level manager who's just trying to get on in his life. And I guess I don't see him necessarily as feeling uncomfortable by uncomfortable within domestic spaces, in general, but it's this particular domestic space which makes him very uncomfortable. And it's because it is huge, it's vast, and they've come from a very kind of well-designed, comfortable apartment in Boston to this vast suburban monstrosity, thousands and thousands of square feet that seem unfillable and are decorated in this kind of awful cod William Morris style. And they immediately strip out all of that design and turn it white. They paint everything white. They try to get rid of all of that ornateness. And that actually makes it worse because it turns into this kind of strange, almost laboratory echo chamber that feels even more suggestive than what was there before.
Right, thank you. And I mean, as we were discussing surveillance earlier, and we were talking about the kind of how surveillance has become an industry and become a big business, and the kind of there's the foreboding presence throughout this book of a kind of poised to take over the world, multi-corporation EKK, who were able to do everything, who were quite reminiscent of a certain company, which I won't name just in case.
There's various potential companies, not just one. It's a kind of amalgamation of companies.
But whilst the cameras are kind of sold as being these elements of safety, there are plenty of disturbing events which occur out of shot, particularly with Copley, the poor little boy, and which almost seem to happen as kind of a direct result of this surveillance. I know we've touched a little bit upon it earlier, but I mean, how do you feel about the surveillance in this contemporary world? And do you find that the presence of the surveillance cameras affected your character's behaviour when you were writing the novel almost, so that if you knew that there was a presence of the camera, it would then affect how you would write the character in their reactions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that some readers felt as though I'd pitched it into dystopia, but in fact, all of the technologies that I describe are already in place somewhere or other, and I think actually I could have pushed it slightly further, because as I was writing it, I was thinking, well, you wouldn't actually have surveillance cameras within the home, but in fact, that's now a thing. So that seemed to me to be kind of at the extreme end of that culture of surveillance. But I did try to think about what the threat of domesticated surveillance would do to the way that people behaved. And then there were also kind of practical problems for the plot too. You know, if there are surveillance cameras within the home, then somebody's monitoring them and we'll see what's going on, and I can't have that happening. I need for there to be an element of mystery still in the home. So I guess that does sort of place it in a very particular historical moment too. Mm. And I think I saw it as a State of the Nation novel about the states, although I think it has much wider relevance. You know, it's describing things that are happening here and that are happening in South Africa. There's a description of a school, and many of the kind of security apparatuses in the school are taken from things that have been happening in British schools. So I was trying to kind of blend those in, like the potential use of fingerprinting to have children pay for lunches and things like that, and not really thinking about what the wider implications are for privacy.
That's quite scary. I hadn't realised that. That's really terrifying. And I mean, obviously, you're saying that all of this technology has been in place already, and so that you don't view it as a dystopian novel. It is kind of edging on the territory, and it is coming within the space. I mean, obviously, The Circle was published by Dave Eggers quite recently, and it fits in with, obviously, you reference 1984, and there are implications of kind of Brave New World within it. I mean, when you were you deliberately steering away from that dystopian kind of tag, or did it not really occur to you?
It didn't really occur to me, and I guess I was surprised by it when some people described it as dystopia, and I think it is dystopia if we can agree that we're living in a kind of dystopian present. You know.
Which I think we can agree. we were mentioned earlier kind of that striving individualism that Paul has and has kind of mutated as his way of life. And the kind of that fierce individualism is very characteristic of the American dream, of course. And a few critics have described this novel as charting the breakdown of the American dream through this kind of home ownership and land ownership. How do you feel about the cataloguing of that book as being kind of an examination of the American dream? And were you using Paul to suggest that the kind of fierce independence necessitated by the American dream is ultimately damaging?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely saw it as something which was trying to think about those failures of the American dream and the way that the American dream is a total myth. It's a very seductive myth, and it's one that I think has ruined a lot of Americans, who tried to live beyond their means, and you know, as if purchasing could somehow be a manifestation of the dream rather than something else. But I wanted it to. I guess to think about those failures of community and the failures of neighborliness that I increasingly see in some areas of the US. I see it less in kind of idealized, or places that seem idealized to me, like college towns in the States, which seem like they have a stronger sense of community. But in the larger regional cities, like Omaha, where I grew up, or Albany in upstate New York, where my mother lives, I see a kind of failure of people in neighborhoods to attend to each other in the way that I feel like we did attend to each other when I was growing up. You know, there was a sense of kind of looking after your neighbors when I was growing up that I don't see in the same way.
Do you think that is almost because we're trying, or people are attempting to create communities, as with kind of Paul Grove Extreme, of this idealized neighborhood where everybody was placed under these incredible controls? Do you almost view it that I've kind of completely lost my train of thought.
No, I think I know what you mean. Is it because we're trying
to create communities
that then become kind of sterile and artificial? I think that's part of it, but I think it's also about that shift into a largely online life. You know, so if your life is lived in a virtual world where you can kind of manage your connections to people, it becomes very easy to ignore the people who are right next door to you.
And who have needs. You that have to fulfill in person rather than online.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And to me, I mean, you kind of mentioned this earlier about the kind of gross consumerism which is in play with throughout the novel, and I felt that it was a deeply politicised novel, kind of criticising the increasing privatisation of our public services, the dangers of blind consumerism, the threats of our government being subsumed by these massive corporations. Was that, did you feel like you were writing a political novel? I mean, you said that you've written a State of the Nation book. Do you feel?
No, I feel like it's political. I think that political fiction is slightly out of fashion, actually. But I felt like I couldn't write about the States without writing about politics and writing about what seems to me to be political, even when it's not obviously so. And my first book is about South Africa, and I didn't feel initially that I knew how to write about where I came from, because Omaha seemed like a very boring place. And it was only really after I came back to Omaha after a long absence that I could see these kinds of energies, which in fact make it really interesting and make any place in the States interesting for its own reasons. But that kind of combination of sprawl and ongoing urban disenfranchisement, the kind of crazy income inequality, when I went back to the States to Omaha after a 13-year absence, I was seeing exactly what I then describe in the book, and that's these suburbs of McMansions alongside crumbling farms. And there are very, very few small farms left in Nebraska. Almost everything has been subsumed by agribusiness, so you have huge farms of hundreds of thousands of acres, I guess, I don't know. But very few farms that are small in the way that there's a small farm in this book. So it was trying to think about all those different elements at the same time.
And did you feel that you were writing a gothic novel? Because I mean, to me this feels like a very gothic novel. I mean, you reference other gothic novels throughout it. There's Frankenstein and Dracula and Jane Eyre, and the motif of the haunted house is, you know, particularly prevalent in the American gothic, with the fall of the House of Usher and things like that. Did you do much reading around the gothic tradition? Was it so inherent within your writing that...
I absolutely did. It was very conscious. I wanted the book to be writing back to two kind of main strands, I guess, in American literature, and that it was the Gothic on one hand and the sort of suburban novel on the other hand. So John Cheever was the other kind of major important influence, and his book Bullitt Park. So there's a very direct writing back to Bullitt Park, and a very direct writing back to Hawthorne and the House of the Seven Gables. Yeah.
Great. So in your mind, then, is it the land that is haunted, or is it the people?
So, I mean, Louise invests all kinds of potential and energy into the land, and I don't know that I necessarily believe in that, but I think that, you know, the land sort of resonates with whatever we try to put into it.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I think that's a good... It definitely seems to resonate, this land. I guess I've really got one last question, and then I think perhaps we can move on to reading, and that is the apocalypse nigh? Because it definitely seems to be fallen land.
I hope not. I don't know. I am going back to spend some time in Texas this year, which I've never been to before, and I'm very curious to see what Texas is like, because I feel like that's I don't know. I don't know why I associate Texas with the apocalypse. I probably shouldn't. but I feel very itchy anywhere where I know there are lots of guns. And I feel like there are lots of guns in Texas. So that makes me kind of anxious.
So you haven't started building your own bunker?
No, absolutely not.
Well, that's great. Then we don't need to be worried.
No, I live in hope.
So we have a short reading? And then...
Yeah. So I'm going to read from a couple of different sections, just short passages. The first is from near the beginning of the book. And this is a moment when Louise Washington, who's the African-American farm widow, is going to visit Paul Krovic in prison. It happens in a kind of future, and then most of the events of the book happen in the past. It is her first time inside the walls of a prison. Or no, that's not quite true, because when she was still teaching, she visited a juvenile detention facility where some of her students had spent time. The county called it a youth center, as if it were nothing more ominous than an after-school club for the city's underprivileged. It was located in a cluster of bland institutional buildings that included the county and Veterans Association hospitals, all faced in tan brick. She does not remember being subjected to any kind of search or having to pass through a metal detector, although in retrospect both seem probable. It no longer matters, nor does she remember if she visited anyone specific, or if it was merely an opportunity to view the facility as a kind of public relations exercise for the local corrections department, making itself look good to the educators whose students might end up inside. Louise is certain she was cautioned not to speak with any of the residents she passed in the halls, solitary kids led by uniformed guards, boys avoiding the gaze of everyone around them, girls with long hair worn flopping over their eyes, children with crew cuts and buzz cuts and shaved heads looking at the walls or the floor or the ceiling, and then the other tougher kids who turned to stare at her in ways that were challenging and provocative and perplexingly thrilling. They looked knowledgeable in a way she knew she had not been at their age. So yes, she has been to a detention facility before, but today is the first time she's ever been inside an adult prison, a state penitentiary, although this one is no longer an arm of the state. At some point in the last 10 years, it was offloaded by the budget-slashing legislature and is now a profit-making enterprise for a private corporation that specializes in corrections facilities. When it was built, the prison was a sandstone fortress erupting out of cornfields and pastureland, and even when Louise was growing up, it was on the remote edge of the southwestern suburbs, a part of town she has still never managed to explore despite spending her entire life in the area. Coming upon the prison now, she's surprised to find it surrounded by strip malls and fast food restaurants and a tall white grain elevator from the days when this was still rural land. Across the street stands a 10 million cubic foot white cube with complete cold storage across the top in tall scarlet letters that remain aglow 24 hours a day. Train tracks run past the grain elevator and prison straight into the refrigerated warehouse. Drinking iced tea and watching cars drive by, she waits for her scheduled appointment in a Mexican restaurant across the street. The air is distorted and shimmering from the heat rising off the asphalt. Her head twitches from side to side as if cars mean more to her than freedom, but her eyes are fixed beyond the traffic to the prison yard, open for everyone to see, where inmates in khakis and white t-shirts mill around behind chain-link fencing topped with curling ribbon coils of razor wire under the aim of 9 watchtowers that mark the perimeter. That was based in part on a visit that I made to the Nebraska State Penitentiary, which is in fact next to a cold storage facility. It's not in Omaha, it's in Lincoln. But you can sit in fast food restaurants across the street and look at the inmates milling around in the yard. It's a very strange experience. So the second section is in Louise's voice. All the book is in third person except for Louise's chapters, and those are in first person. And she is in her late 60s. Her grandparents inherited this farm from a white landowner. The sun is going down earlier each evening, summer quitting itself, but still I can see the white man at the bus stop from a block away. It's only when he boards that I realize he's in uniform. For a moment, I think the vest he wears says KKK, and my heart rumbles, but then my eyes come together, and I see the first K is an E, and all the man is doing is checking tickets. Under those 3 capital letters is an unfamiliar phrase, revenue protection. Maybe it's because I haven't been riding buses much lately, but it used to be enough to pay the driver and get off at your stop. I fish the ticket from my purse, and the revenue protection man looks at it and then at me, as if the little white slip should somehow correspond to the shape and features of my face. He puts it back in my hand without saying anything and goes on to the next person. Everyone has a ticket. I wonder what would happen if someone didn't, if he'd whip out a smart black fine book or slap a pair of silver cuffs around offending wrists. He gets off at the next stop, crosses the street, waiting for a bus headed back into town. How many times I've driven this road, watched it change over the last decades, but if I were my young self again, I would see nothing familiar about any of it, not the phrases or faces or the houses where there used to be fields surrounding our own. Just before the last stop, I press the yellow strip of tape running along the window, and as I get off, I thank the driver. The man doesn't even look at me, as if I were an apparition, as though I might never have existed at all. I trudge along the hot sidewalk where buffalo grass used to grow, past a brick wall where I remember split rail fences. I come to our land, to that place where the forest reaches all the way to Poplar Road, and the cottonwoods, in their thick-trunked waltz, bow down and say, "Here you are, Louise, here you come." I remember when this stretch of road was still dirt, and Donald and I stood at the edge of the property watching the men and cement trucks, knowing it was the end of the way we and our people had lived upon this land my grandparents inherited, land my freeman forebears tenanted before a stroke of most unlikely luck delivered it into their name. Great-grandparents sharecropped before that, arrived on it newly free and looking for a way of living in the quiet of the seasons, hope humming in their ears. Through the trees, I see the white hem of our house, a silver ghost like my dead Donald, belted with an apron of porch, teacup sky overhead, clouds rimmed in gold. I take the wood path to avoid the eyes of neighbors where there didn't used to be any, follow my feet along tracks I could walk blind from first walking, 50 paces to the north, feel the tug of the pole, then my old sharp turn left and 20 more paces through tree cover until I step into the corrugations of the garden, the sky darkening to a purple bronze. Now I stand alone. In many ways, the book is about Louise's sense of loss that she's trying to manage, the loss of this property. And then it's about her confrontation and Paul Krovic's confrontation with this family from the East Coast, Nathaniel and Julia and their son Copley. And this next section is a very short passage, which is about the three of them driving to this city, which remains unnamed. In the middle of their three-day drive from the East Coast, buffeted by semi-trucks and four-wheel drive sport utility vehicles through rain so dense and blinding they eventually cannot see the cars in front of them, they are forced to brake for the second night sooner than planned in a tiny town 10 miles off the interstate where the only motel is all but full of truckers. Although he has allowed himself to be persuaded by Julia this is the right decision, that their futures lie somewhere beyond, far beyond, the city where they have built their lives together so far, Nathaniel can't escape the feeling that the move is not just idiotic, but potentially catastrophic. The feeling, he thinks, handing over the credit card to one of the two girls behind the desk at reception, the other one watches the local weather report, which forecasts more of the same. "Biblical rain," the meteorologist shouts into the camera, eyes goggling, is rooted not only in a negative reaction to moving away from his hometown or the panic he feels at transferring to a more senior position in his company, but in the new house itself, and in the prospect of living out a span of his life on the margins of a provincial city. He is unprepared for suburban life. He does not speak the language of lawns and yard maintenance, of barbecues and block parties and Independence Day picnics, soccer and Little League, and all the social pressures he imagines will accompany their days in Dolores Woods. His parents never taught him that language. They did their best, he knows, to be sure he had no chance to learn it. With the keys in their possession, and the time until their arrival at the new house measurable in hours rather than days or weeks, the three of them sharing a motel room last redecorated 20 years ago, the curtains and bedspreads reeking of cigarette smoke, even though it is supposed to be a non-smoking room, the crunch of the ice dispenser outside their door pulling him out of sleep every half hour as the party of truckers down the hall stumbles along to fill up their buckets for another round of beers, Nathaniel feels feverish with doubt and regret, holding his breath as the three men laugh outside in the hall, cigarette smoke filtering under the door, ice cubes rattling into cheap plastic, stories of sexual conquests stage whispered among the men and audible in the room. He wants to tell them to shut up and go back to bed, to warn them they're disturbing the sleep of his wife and child, but he fears what they might do to a man as small and obviously weak as he is. He picks up the phone to complain to the front desk, but it rings and rings, and no one answers. Okay, I think I have time to read just one other section. And this is a section which is from the perspective of Nathaniel and Julia's son, Copley, who's about 7 or 8 years old. Copley's a very unusual child who thinks in a slightly literalist way about time in particular. Some readers have misread him as autistic. He's not autistic. He's just quite odd. 9:05 a.m. He has missed the Pledge of Allegiance and the singing of America the Beautiful, and Mrs. Pitt is already 10 minutes into math, which is the first period of the day. They are still working on adding and subtracting in fractions and are spending the week on word problems, which most of his classmates find difficult. No one else in class knows how to multiply or divide, and when he has asked Mrs. Pitt about when they will be doing multiplication and division, she's explained that those topics will only be covered next year, the first half of the year on multiplication tables, the second half on division. The delay makes no sense to him because he is comfortable with numbers, understanding them as if they were people, boys and girls. 1 is a boy, 2 is a girl, 3 is a boy, 4 a boy, 5 a boy, 6 a girl, 7 a boy, his own age, 8 a girl, 9 a girl, 10 a boy, 11 a boy, 12 a girl, 13 a boy, 14 a boy, and so on. Ask him any number and he can tell you if it is a boy or a girl. 312 is a girl, 1791 is a boy, 1829 is a girl. When Mrs. Pitt sees him come in the door, she frowns. Like the student, she wears a uniform, khaki skirt, blue shirt, red wool sweater. Quote, a grown-up patriot for all of you little patriots to emulate. Have you been to the office, she asks. Yes, Mrs. Pitt, he says. Take your seat, Copley, she says, and he finds his place in the desk at the very back of the first row. His name is written on a piece of yellow paper that is supposed to look like a ruler, but to his mind it has been poorly drawn, and the O has been left out of his last name. When he told Mrs. Pitt his name was misspelled, she said a new sign would be made for his desk, but one has never appeared, and he knows he will spend this semester labeled with a name not his own. Although the day is dark and rain is pouring outside, the blinds have been lowered over the bank of windows that extends the whole length of the classroom. The slats are open, but the effect is deadening. In the adjacent wing, he can see other classrooms with their blinds also lowered, the lights on inside. The room smells damp, and next to him sits a girl called Emily, who has blonde hair that looks gray near her scalp. She has pinkish-gray skin, and has missed several days of school since he first arrived. He suspects she is slowly dying because she smells like rotten eggs, and her skin and hair are always gray. She is rotting from the inside out, and no one is bothering to notice but him. Of the 20 students in his class, he knows all their names and almost nothing about any one of them except Jocelyn, who sits in front of him. Not only is she the only black person in the whole school apart from the lunch ladies, she is also his only friend, although he is not even sure if they are actually friends. Every day, Mrs. Pitt finds an excuse to say to the two of them something like, "There, Jocelyn and Copley, right where I can keep an eye on you two," as if they've done something wrong. Jocelyn is the only person who has ever spoken to him at recess because he thinks no one speaks to her, the two outsiders of the classroom, thrown together by virtue of being ignored by everyone else. He understands that if he is going to have a play date, Jocelyn is the only possible candidate. They are the two smartest students in class, and this, he realizes, is the reason Mrs. Pitt fears them. They know better than to speak before lunch. Speaking is never allowed unless Mrs. Pitt calls on them when they raise their hands to answer a question. Speaking is not allowed during water and bathroom breaks because they might disturb other classrooms. Speaking is only allowed at lunch and recess. In his Boston school, there was group time and free periods when you could speak to each other and work on creative projects. At the Pinwheel Academy, there is no group time and no free periods. He looks up at the black glass hemisphere in the center of the ceiling, but cannot tell whether there is only one camera monitoring the room or a number of cameras nesting inside. Sometimes he hears a whirring, churning noise and imagines it is the camera turning, focusing, taking a picture of him and his work.
Thank you very much for your reading. I have to admit to not having heard of you before or the book. But that up. I love the library, and I get my books online at the library. And it's actually the last character, Copley.
Hmm.
I think, oh, what an amazing character. Well, I love him already. I'm interested with the name.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm unfamiliar with American names. Is it a name that's known?
No.
It's a character born out of his name, because that's interesting. And I sort of know that boy, because how irritating is that? My surname's always been misspelled.
Hmm.
And I had a difficult maiden name. I've had a... It shouldn't be a difficult married name, but
mm.
I haven't. People always misspell, and it's so annoying, isn't
mm.
it? So
mm.
I immediately fell in love with this boy and his friend. So tell me a little bit more about him. Where did he
yeah.
come from in your mind, in your creative mind?
Yeah. So his, I'm trying to think whether his name came first or if he came first as a character. I think his name came first. It's not a common American name at all, but the joke in the book is that his parents named him after the square on which they lived in Boston, Copley Square. And there's an odd kind of connection with between Copley and the name Noai. There's the painter John Singleton Copley, who painted portraits of the Noai family, I think, in the 18th century, potentially. I've got the facts wrong, I'm certain. But as a character, he is very closely modeled on me as a child. I gendered my numbers and letters at the age of 7 as a way to kind of make sense of math, because I have a sense that I have some kind of math problem in my mind. I've never been diagnosed, but in order to make sense of numbers, I had to give them a kind of personality. And so that was something.
So that's
that
not unusual,
yeah.
Or indeed colors it could be. So
yeah,
it's not
yeah. And he has a certain synesthetic quality
yeah.
too. So he senses things in multiple ways. But he's very concerned with time and feels very out of place in this new world that they've moved into. So he and his father, to a certain extent, are kind of mirrors of each other
mm.
because they both feel out of place. But Copley becomes the kind of focus of the family hysteria about what may be happening to them. And he becomes the suspect in a way which feels deeply unfair to him, because he knows of anybody in the book what is actually happening. So that's not about my childhood.
That's really interesting.
But that kind of, that odd sort of slant view of the world
yeah.
I took from myself.
Yeah, one of my favourite things about the novel is the form of it, and that it's not uniform all
mm.
the way through, that there are bits, like you said, Louise's part is first person, there are bits in present or in past tense, there's
mm.
the wonderful conversation all happening at once across
yeah.
the two pages, and how Copley's is written with the times, you know. I'm really interested in your decisions about the form of the novel, whether that was before you started, whether it came with any of the subject matter or the characters,
yeah.
or, you know, just developed naturally.
It was a reasonably slow process. Initially, there was a different frame narration. There was a different character who was a kind of frame narrator who was a journalist, and I decided that didn't work, and so I took him out. And put Louise in his place, and that kind of opened up other possibilities for where the book goes. And then within the kind of body of the book, between that frame narration, it was more or less stable in terms of its progression throughout the drafting process. And I knew that I wanted certain slightly odd elements. Louise's voice was initially in third person. It was a very free and direct discourse style, and it wasn't working. So I decided to put it into first person. And Copley's main chapter I wrote in a single day. So it was it's about a 10,000 word chapter, and it came very, very quickly and very easily, and was lightly edited. And then there's a memorandum that Julia writes to her doctors or to posterity. And that was kind of dictated by how I saw her mind working. She's a scientist, a roboticist, and I felt as though she needed a kind of a slightly cold approach to everything that was happening. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Thank you.
Sure.
So you mentioned this novel working in both the American Gothic and suburban traditions, and you grew up in the States, but you were further educated in England and now live here.
Yeah.
And so do you think of yourself as an American writer, British writer? Do certain projects fall into one or other category? And what do you see as sort of the differences in those two literatures and how do you work within them?
Yeah. I think when I wrote the first book, I didn't see clearly where I fit, but I now feel I now feel very clearly that I'm an American novelist who happens to be based here. The third book is an attempt to write about Britain and America. It's sort of an attempt to bridge those two investments, and that comes out next year. But I think for me, there's a potential in American literature for a kind of big political novel that I don't quite see in the same way in British literature. I think Britain is fantastic at doing these incredibly realistic, vivid portraits of place and you know, a very deep understanding of place and locality, and seems slightly resistant to me to the political. That may be a misimpression, but that's how I feel as a writer. And I think that I find increasingly that all the themes that I want to write to are ones that seem to be most alive to me in an American context. Which is not to say that I don't feel invested in Britain, because I'm also now a dual citizen. But I think Britain makes it quite difficult to assimilate. You know, I find even after almost 14 years here that I continue to be reminded of my otherness and my outsiderness, you know, even from fellow writers who say, you're not British, you will never be British. Don't make a mistake. and I don't resent that either. I think that there are some American writers I can think of who have made that transition and are now British writers, but I don't feel capable of doing that. I think it's in part because of those writers having relationships with a British partner, a spouse. My partner is South African, so I feel more clearly that that's kind of the axis of my creative and intellectual interest. Not that I'm not interested in Britain, but I'm trying to write about Britain in this third book, and I found it really difficult, actually. Yeah.
Mm. But I think you just answered my question. Your connection with South Africa interests me.
Yeah, so...
did you live there?
No,
it's
just through my partner. We've been together since 2003,
okay.
2002, in fact. And I started traveling there in 2003. And the first book grew up quite slowly, but I began that in 2005 after I'd made a couple of trips there,
mm-hmm.
and then continued going back as I was finishing it. But it was about a six-year process of getting to know it, getting to know the country,
yeah.
and one aspect of the culture, because it's such a complex landscape.
I was interested in the opening of the book, set in 1919, the racial rights, the racial hatred. This was, I find it hard to connect this with the Midwest, because in the UK we tend to think of racial trouble in America in the deep south, Mississippi, Alabama.
Yeah.
But it surprised me how all pervasive it was right across all the states of America. Was it something that you experienced in Omaha?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the city in the novel is based on Omaha, but it's intentionally unnamed because I wanted it to function as a kind of anywhere place. But Omaha has a very, very dark, very complex history of race hate. It was one of the sites of lynching in the 20th century, and in 1919 in particular. The lynching in the book is not exactly what happened in Omaha, but it's close to it. And Omaha had, at the time, the largest population of African Americans west of the Mississippi outside of Los Angeles. That was part of the Great Migration. There were people coming to work in the railroad and the meatpacking industries. But there was a really pernicious system of something which was almost like an American apartheid. And that was a system called protective covenants and redlining. So banks would literally draw a red line on the map around a neighborhood where they would not grant any loans. And other neighborhoods would have protective covenants, which would mean that nobody could sell to or rent to African-American families in those areas. And even though those laws were found to be illegal, I think in the 1940s even, the effects continued. Yeah, and then, you know, right up to the present, you can drive to North Omaha and it's still a majority African-American neighborhood. There's very little social mobility. Yeah. But it is, I mean, when I went to university on the East Coast, I said I went to school in Omaha's ghetto, effectively. People couldn't believe me, because I went to magnet school, so it was a program of busing to promote desegregation. And I went to these schools from the age of 9. And people on the East Coast said, what do you mean there are no ghettos in Omaha? No, seriously. I grew up with gangs and drive-by shootings and the whole shebang.
So I think we've got time for one more question.
Yeah.
Maybe two, depending.
I really love this book. And I think when I was reading it, especially towards the end, I was feeling so terrified at the kind of what was happening. And I wondered, without giving any away, your character's sort of sympathy really shifts.
Mm.
And some characters that I hadn't really felt any sympathy for at the beginning, by the end I was sort of weirdly feeling a bit softer towards, and other characters completely chilling. And I wondered what your sort of, was that an intentional curve, or did that come out as the story went on?
It's kind of both. So in part, I wanted to try with Paul Krovic to write about somebody whose ideology I find totally foreign to myself. You know, I find it toxic.
Mm.
But I wanted to see if I could write into that in a way which was potentially sympathetic,
mm.
and find a way of making him somebody who was sympathetic, and to do the reverse with Nathaniel.
Yeah.
You know, to take somebody whose politics are very close to my own and think about how they can be.
I think that's what's
twisted.
So chilling is the idea that of what.
Probably got time for one more.
Yeah.
How has the book been received in America? Have you spent much time there since?
No. I haven't spent much time there. It had some very nice reviews. And then silence. So I think it's, I suspect it's a very difficult book for Americans to read.
Do you think it would make a good film?
I do. I think it would make great TV.
Especially the beginning with the sinkhole.
Yeah.
And the lynching and the people, the bodies going down the hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So crazy.
It has all the tropes of a horror.
Yeah.
You know, but explained, so we're in understanding what's happening.
Mm.
But it's a haunted house. It's
still very creepy.
It's a house invasion. It
mm.
sort of reminds me of stuff like Last House on the Left and really
mm.
a home invasion sort of. Base roots kind of terror, but
mm.
it's got this subtext. So
yeah, it's playing with all that genre stuff as well,
but
doing so in a way which is also trying to subvert the expectations of those genres, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Patrick. Can we all clap twice as loudly?